sitting next to Helen on the Democratic side when the Greek-Turkish aid bill was under consideration for military assistance to Greece and Turkey, which was then considered a distinctly essential move in order to avoid communist takeovers, especially in Greece and probably in Turkey too. Helena was a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, told me she was going to vote against these bills. And I pleaded with her, as I knew she was going to run for the Senate in 1948, on every possible ground that I could think of, not to do it, to vote for the bill, as I was and other internationally minded members of the Congress and of the Foreign Relations Committee were going to. I pleaded with her until she literally answered the roll call, voting no. And indeed, that vote proved to be her undoing in the race that she ran with Richard Nixon as her opponent in California.
I arrived at the White House at 7:30 p.m. on Election Day and found the president on the second floor in the living room with the television already going, and Joe Garagiola was there, as well as former Representative Edith Green and another friend of the president's, apparently from Grand Rapids. The president was having a drink. I ordered one. And then in about a half hour, a few other guests arrived. Incidentally, it was interesting to me that when I came into the Southwest Gate, there was no guest list, really, though they apparently knew I was coming. The gate was not prepared, as it usually is when you go to the White House, for a number of people, and I was admitted kind of specially and obviously as if I were a member of the family. And similarly, there were very few cars parked outside the entrance that you use when you use a Southwest gate. And one of the White House staff, obviously the domestic staff, was waiting for me and took me up to the second floor where I met the president I've just described.
What did the president
say? The president was delighted to see me, said hello and glad you came, Jack, and we don't know what'll happen, but at least we'll see what happens together. And Betty is will be out to join us soon. The president's daughter, Susan, was there when I arrived, as well as his son Jack, who kind of went in and out, and as did Susan. Susan had a couple of golden retrievers that were kind of, you know, all over the place, and lovely dogs. And it was obviously very much a family atmosphere. And the president, as I say, said that Betty would be out very soon to join us. And we had a drink and watched very preliminary returns, mainly featured by the appreciation of the map which NBC was going to, upon which NBC was going to report the returns, with nothing lit up on the map, whatever. And within about, 30 minutes, about 10 young people arrived, which was Joe Garagiola's wife and his daughters and their husbands or boyfriends. And not too long thereafter, Tom Ford arrived. Just before Tom Ford's arrival, Mike Ford and his wife came in and were introduced, and the talk was generally about where the children had been in the campaign, with a special reference to how those particular states would respond. Mike, for example, said that he'd been in Wisconsin. And, places that the children had been, where Susan had been, where Mike had been, and my recollection is that Mike spoke of Wisconsin. Susan had apparently been elsewhere, in New York or wherever. And that apparently the children of the president took very great pride in their participation in the campaign and felt a very special responsibility for those particular areas coming in for the president. And that was the only item of conversation. Otherwise, it was pleasantries. Everybody had a drink. No food was served at that particular point. And just sat around waiting for something to happen in the way in their returns. The president participated in the small talk and really was just interested in his children. There was nothing really special. Susan had trouble with her dogs, who insisted on getting in everybody's lap, and the kind of big dogs that shed a bit. And she commanded them, and they obeyed very very neatly. But it was just the family members getting around the television waiting for something to happen. And that, I think, took all the preliminaries, though Cronkite was on, and he was on with his team, and we switched from Cronkite and his team, which was Kathy Mackin and Tom Brokaw, and no, Tom Brokaw was NBC. It was an NBC map. No, but we watched Cronkite for a while. We had one set at that particular time. I'm just trying to think of who's on with Cronkite, because Cronkite had a number of... Moyers, exactly right. Cronkite and Moyers were kicking the ball around. And Mike Wallace came in later. And we switched to NBC with David Brinkley and John Chancellor and Kathy Mackin and Tom Brokaw. That was the order of events. And there was really no other station listened to. Those were the two, primarily. And I had the distinct impression, and I think the president did, that practically everybody in both shows, I didn't see a sign of difference. You had the sensibility, the feeling that they were rooting for Carter. And I think the president felt that. Nobody on both shows was rooting for him. I think when it was very noticeable that for example, one of the networks, I think it was NBC, ran just before the results began to come in, Governor Carter's mother sitting next to an old-fashioned stove with an old-fashioned pipe outlet and saying some things about her not going to Atlanta, she's going to stay home. I mean, you would have run that in a film or in a commercial for Carter. I mean, you know, it was so obvious and so rather corny, as a matter of fact. So she's a very nice woman. Well, I think the president, you know, just joined in the general chit-chat that obviously, you know, this it was kind of all for Carter and very little room for him, so much so that I suggested to him that where were his people, like Mary Louise, Strauss got on the TV. Where were his people, Mary Louise Smith and Jim Baker and so on? The president said they're undoubtedly standing by and will be on in due course. But it was very clear, and I think very noticeable to him, that this was pretty much a Democratic Party show. The president said, by way of comment, that that's more like a campaign commercial than news, but what's the difference at this stage of the proceedings? If it's on, it's on. It really isn't of any major moment. Immediately after this little vignette, Betty Ford arrived, kissed everybody, made sure everybody had a drink, and sort. Everybody sat down. By then, Joe Gargiulo's family had already been there. So that was, I mean, they were fixed in place. Gargiulo was largely in a jovial mood, told the story about how he had held up a sign in Buffalo, which had gotten a big laugh and a big cheer, which said, Italians for Betty. And even the president laughed and shared that one. I would say that the most sensitively attuned person in the room at that time was Mrs. Green. She headed Democrats for Ford, and her general feeling, and she was very good, by the way, on television for the president, the television that I was with her on, and the national show on the Monday night, which the president did. I think she kind of gave me the feeling that she had the most to lose of anybody there, in terms of, it was interesting, even, I think she was even more sensitively attuned than the president. Now, the president was obviously tired. He was, well, I've rarely seen him before. He was flushed, looked tired, and his voice was already beginning to give out then. He really was quite hoarse and could hardly talk, so he did not participate all that much in the conversation. I would describe the demeanor of the children as being very much the children and the father. You know, everybody goes about his business, seemingly not noticing the old man, but at the same time with a certain sense of, I felt, a certain aura of their own importance. That is, that they were conscious of the fact that this was the president's house and that they were the president's children. Even though, rather elaborately, the relations were matter of fact and indeed very intimate, you know. There's no feeling that this is a family that stood on ceremony at all. There was kidding, there was banter, there was, you know, the president hugged his daughter, and generally a very atmosphere of affection and lightness, but I felt underneath it all a consciousness that the children knew where, who they were and where they were. Well, I think the informality was demonstrated by the fact that Susan kicked their shoes off, and within a short time after, immediately after her mother arrived, got a lie on her back on the carpet, and the president tossed her a couple of pillows to put under her head. Somebody, I think it was one of the members of Gargiulo's family, spilled a drink, or Susan spilled the drinks with the ice and whatnot, but nobody said a word. She picked up some of the ice, and one of the domestic employees did the rest. Nobody said recognized it by so much as a word or a gesture. The president hugged his wife when she came into the room. Got up and went to her and hugged her, and she kissed everybody. That was very sweet. She sat on a chair. We were sitting in a circle at that point. She sat on a chair rather near the television and across the room from the president. The president sat in what would be the northeast corner of the room, of this living room, which is quite a large room, in an easy chair, watching the television. Well, Susan was lying on the floor in the middle of the room, right, as you would lie in front of a fireplace. But, of course, this was a TV set. The president's son, Mike, sat next to me on the sofa, which was at right angles to the right of the president, at the end of kind of the flank, you know, at right angles at the end of the room, where the room ended. And the girl sitting next to Mrs. Ford was his wife, Mike's wife. But all the other chairs were taken, essentially, by Gargiulo's family and Mrs. Green and Gargiulo himself. At that point, returns began to come in from the South. And the map began to fill in. The first return was... The filled in red was Georgia. That apparently came in the first. Second, I would say, was Alabama. A third was Florida. And Louisiana didn't come along until late. Late in that southern block filling in. And that was the first time the president expressed disappointment and said that, gee, I thought we had a real chance to carry that. I think that was disappointing. Also, interspersed with the results, state results, I mean, the state results were determined by the fact that the network would say, we give this state to so-and-so based on our key precincts, etc. And the president and I at that time talked about the fact that, you know, what difference did it make who they gave it to? The question is who it went to. And that yet they, the commentators on the television, treated it as if when they gave it to somebody, that was the end of it, that somebody had won it. But, of course, when the results came in later, their decisions seemed to be the correct ones, except in the very close ones. I did notice, however, that in the case of Maryland, they shifted back and forth. They just conveniently forgot that they had just given Maryland to Ford or to Carter and just went on and reported Maryland results. I think I've said that. I said, you know, sounds makes you think like they're giving the election away. And he said, that's right. He said, you know, they proceed on the theory when they give it to somebody, that somebody is going to win it. Today, the southern states begin to fill in red. And, of course, on the NBC map, red was Carter and blue, light blue was... Garagiola was, you know, come on, he... Joe Garagiola at this point began to cheer with come on, blue. And I'm just trying to think of the first blue we saw, first state that the president carried. I think the president also commented on how fast the map filled in red. The southern states came in very rapidly, and the singular holdout among the southern states was Virginia. And the president commented. Joe Garagiola began to cheer for, show us some blue. And I'm trying to think now of the first state which NBC conceded to the president, and that was Connecticut. And the president said, what a thrill that Connecticut actually came through and that they got themselves together. I certainly am very grateful to the Republicans of Connecticut. And not soon thereafter, because the reports were already coming in favorably from New Jersey. New Jersey turned blue, and that's when Joe really went wild. By then, however, the configuration of the map, aside from Louisiana and Texas, was red. And to my mind, the president's key states that he was really looking at very hard were Texas and Pennsylvania. My impression is that he really felt he would carry Texas. And he said that Connally had made a number of calls to the president while I was there. I didn't hear the conversation, but he had, and the president reported that, telling the president not to worry about adverse early results from Texas. And they were adverse. But when Texas still showed Carter ahead and 70% of the vote had been counted, which was not very late, could have been as early as 9 o'clock, 9-ish, Connally again called the president and said, told him it wasn't looking so good. Well, yes, he went out of the room for these calls. But along about 9 o'clock, I would say, I went to the president and I said, look, Mr. President, he was then at another television. By that time, another television had been opened up in a very long room, which was also a continuation of the living room we were in. It had a long series of living rooms on the second floor. A And this was the number two living room, where another set had been opened. And the president kind of sat at both in the course of the night. But the one he sat at the longest and the most was the one he started with. But he shifted from one to one. Also, by that time, Mrs. Ford had said anybody who wants a bite to eat could get it. And there was a buffet, and everybody helped themselves. And the president did. He had some food rather promptly. He went to the other set, and I went to him. He was sitting, you know, two chairs from me. He's then sitting in an armchair, quite out in the middle of the room, really. And I said, Mr. President, it seems ridiculous to me that you're not getting the detailed reports that must be pouring into the National Committee from the professionals on the ground. What's, you know, the difference between what did happen and would happen in a given place, etc. And he said, well, that's true, Jack. Why don't you arrange it? And I said, well, I'll call Mary Louise Smith immediately. So I went into his bedroom and called Mary Louise Smith, and I said, what's going on here? The president is not, as a candidate in the President of the United States, being kept informed as I would be kept informed if I were running for a House seat. She said, you're absolutely right. She said, we'll round it up immediately, and may we continue to call you all evening, giving you these detailed bulletins. And I said, you certainly may, and you certainly should. So from then on, I was getting calls from Mary Louise Smith about every 10 minutes or 20 minutes with latest results, and one that stood vividly in my mind of these conversations, of which there were maybe five, and then they dribbled out as the result became clear. But one conversation which she told me that in Pennsylvania, which to me was a key, I told her that I had my eyes on Pennsylvania because I thought that was really a key. She said that in Pennsylvania, the president had come out of Philadelphia losing by about 260-odd thousand. And that he could make it, they figured, it was 240-odd thousand, not 260-odd, 240-odd thousand. And that they felt that if he lost by more than 250,000 Philadelphia, he couldn't make it in Pennsylvania. But she said, notwithstanding that report, Heinz came out of Philadelphia losing by 300,000. And he's making it because he's getting a tremendous vote in the Pittsburgh area. So I said, now, is the president getting the same thing? She said, he is not. He is not getting the same thing that Heinz is. Heinz is running ahead of him materially in the Pittsburgh area as a test. Another one of the reports that she gave me concerned itself with Wisconsin, which also we had expected to carry Wisconsin, but it doesn't look too good. On the other hand, I got the distinct impression from the president that the Connecticut and New Jersey victories were very welcome, though they had counted on New Jersey and Connecticut, but they were very, very welcome, and they began to break the monotony of the red map. Now that again I recall it, I think the first state that went for the president was Kansas. The first blue, and the president commented that he wished they had, as the president said, I wish they had as many people out there as they have land. He said, it looks great on the map, but there are mighty few electoral votes. No. I went to the president and told him personally each item as it was reported to me, and he obviously very pleased with the fact that I was doing this. He would listen with interest. He made no comment on Pennsylvania. Now, the results came in from the farm states rather quickly. That is Oklahoma, Nebraska, not Iowa. Iowa was a long, long time holdout. And the president said, it is so gratifying to me that we were able to hold the farm vote in these farm states. Now, along about that time, as the map was lighting up in the Middle West, Texas began to show red, and the president expressed rather deep disappointment that we had lost Texas. Something like, I don't like that red in Texas. That doesn't look too good to me. Also, periodically, throughout the whole evening, the popular vote was being shown. The president did not express any dismay at the electoral vote, because you had the whole South and speedily began to be 4-1 caught up in electoral votes. But they were still, say, around under 150 in the 130s
Bracken. But the president expressed no dismay at that. He expected that. But the popular vote hung hour after hour at 51-48, and the president said, that's not so good. I think the hanging of the popular vote impressed him more than the electoral vote. No. But I had the distinct feeling that what was running through his mind was, here I am, the president. What is the popular support? How many of the people really want me to continue? I think he would have, I had the distinct feeling that he would have not been too happy to have won it with the electoral vote and not with the popular vote. That the popular vote registered very heavily with his mind as a vote of approval of his policies, etc. Well, he said that popular vote seems to be hanging right there and it doesn't move hardly a hair. It was a factual comment, but I think it revealed what was in his mind. Matter of fact, I think the president said those CBS guys are really quick on the trigger, not in a flattering way. And at that particular point, the mountain states opened up. And the president, there were cheers, of course, every time a state went for the president. You know, the children cheered, and Joe Garagiola was the cheerleader. He's a very effervescent person. But when the mountain states opened up, the president said, God, that blue really looks good. Again, he repeated, I sure wish there were as many people as there is land in those great western areas. Particular point, when the South was in, the mountain states and the farm states were in, Connecticut was in, New Jersey was in, but neither Ohio nor Illinois nor Michigan nor Iowa were in. Dick Cheney arrived with Bob Tita, the pollster. That was about, must have been around 11 to 12 p.m., motioned to the president, or indicated the president, they wanted to talk to him. And he went in the room where the buffet had been set up with them, and they were sitting in three, you know, stand-up chairs, when Dick Cheney came out and said, the president wants you with him. And I went in the room, and what they did was to give the president a rundown and told him that they didn't think that was as yet decisive, and there really was nothing for him to say. And the president, turned to me and asked, you know, said, Jack, what do you think? And I said, I thoroughly agree, Mr. President. It's much too premature, and there really is nothing for you to say. Oh, they came in and volunteered the information. Now, whether you'd asked Dick to come over on the phone, as Dick was in his office in the White House all night, or not, I have no idea. But from the atmosphere, I would say that by then they were seeing a trend and that they came in to report to him, and to make a recommendation to do nothing, and he concurred in that, and I concurred in it. Dick Cheney took the president took Dick Cheney into a bedroom across the hall. I think it was Mrs. Ford's bedroom. 5 minutes, someone came and said, the president wants to see you. And I went into the room with Cheney and the president. Cheney then told me that they had had information from New York that the vote count was being withheld in certain districts in the South Bronx and in Brooklyn, and that they had talked to Rosenbaum and to Lefkowitz, and that Rosenbaum and had said that he thought that an order ought to be obtained to impound the voting machines, and that Lefkowitz was the one to obtain it. Lefkowitz had then said he would do it if the White House requested it. At which point I said that I thoroughly disagreed with that. The White House should not request it. It had no evidence as yet, but that the White House should ask the Attorney General to run it down, to get the evidence, and that if he did get the evidence, that the state committee should do it. So I talked on the telephone then and there with Lefkowitz, and talked on the telephone then and there with Rosenbaum. And Rosenbaum concurred and said that he would get Lefkowitz to run down this evidence, see if there was evidence. And I said that one of the ways in which you can get the evidence is by finding out from the police department what had been unreported from Brooklyn and the Bronx. There may be nothing as a fact. This may not be true. So he said that they had done that, and in fact, there were a deficiency in such reports from certain areas of Brooklyn and the Bronx, and that he would have, that the state committee would itself make the complaint if they decided that there were facts behind this situation. Now, at that time, I did not know what I heard later, that Ron Nessen had gone out and indicated that it was the White House which had requested the state committee to impound these machines. But that was not the conversation. The conversation was that the state committee should satisfy itself as to the facts independently, and that it should be the party complaining because it had the basic facts itself. The only thing that Cheney had was a tip, really, from somebody that this was happening. And he felt it serious enough to ask the president, and the president felt it serious enough to ask me. As the president mentioned, that I had been a former attorney general of New York, and I was the logical one to help them make this decision. He said that when I came in the room. And I said, of course, that's absolutely true, and here is the situation. This is what I think you ought to do. Now, I'm a little unsure as to whether I talked to Rosenbaum or Lefkowitz, and I wish that there was agreement that that was the thing to do. The thing to do was to run it down, to be sure it was a solid fact, and then to take the action based on the state committee's complaint, because it would then have been seized of the facts.